All right, joining us now, our good friend, author of, I'm telling you, maybe the best titled book ever, Unfriended, Ted Bishop, the 38th president of the PGA of America. Ted, welcome back in.
Hey, Mike, thanks for having me.
Yeah, man, we love having you on, especially when we have an opportunity to talk in macro issues, and there's a lot of stuff going on with golf. And before we get into some of the specifics, we had a question earlier in the show about Tiger Woods launching his big comeback to what we hope will be an epic season at Torrey, and that it's great for Torrey, and he's probably excited because it's a place that he's won 8 times, including the 2008 U.S. Open. But Torrey's a tough course. It's running out at 7,700 yards, and they've still got the rough looks like it did back at the U.S. Open. Is this the right place for him to come back?
Well, I think that's a great question, Mike. And my good friend Alex Maselli actually did a story yesterday on morningread.com, which is something that any of your listeners would find interesting day in and day out on that very subject. And, you know, Maselli pointed out that the last few times that Woods has actually played at Torrey, he finished T80, had a withdrawal and a missed cut, and he's not broken par there since second round 71 in 2014. And as you just mentioned, when he did win there in 2013, the North Course played just over 7,000 yards. And of course, now, it's where the South Course, where the last two rounds are being played, it's going to be about 7,700 yards. So, you know, Maselli's take, and I really hadn't thought much about it until I read his article, but I agree, was that maybe Tiger would have been better suited to have started in Honolulu or even in Palm Springs, where, you know, the weather's going to be warm, the scoring's going to be easier. These are some places where he could possibly build some confidence in his game rather than, you know, jump right into the fire at Torrey Pines. So I kind of tend to agree with that analogy.
Yeah, I mean, my concerns are, you know, is maybe that Tiger, you know, Tiger doesn't, he gets out there and he wants to overpower the course and maybe he overdoes it or really gets caught up in some of that. If he's not hitting the fairways, he gets caught up in some of that deep, thick, dense, you know, deeply rooted rough and again tries to overswing. And it's just going to be, you know, if he can't manage his own, I don't know, it's not necessarily ego, but his desire to be the Tiger of old, if we don't see this much more mature Tiger willing to manage the golf course instead of dominate the golf course, I'm just afraid he could get hurt. I look at the seventh hole and I think it's the 12th hole, these long 450, 500 yard par fours that they could give him real trouble. They've got average scoring, you know, in the, for the PGA Tour is they have less than, those two holes see less than 5% birdies. And if you go out there and try to beat those two holes, you're in trouble.
No, I totally agree with you. Although I will say, when I watched him play in December and I will say I had written him off. I had done some shows like yours and basically had been asked the question, you know, what do you think of Hughes? And I just said, I think he's done it. But I did a complete 360-degree stand on that in December when I saw how far he was hitting it and when I saw who he was out driving and heard some of those guys talk about how far he was hitting it past them at times. And you know, that told me that, you know, maybe he's found something. And then I think the other thing that's been good for him in the past month, he's obviously kind of announced that he's taken a lot more conservative approach from the instructional side of it. And, you know, he's kind of going to be his own guy. And I don't think that, you know, anybody that probably knows his game any better than he does. And I think that was a real positive sign. I think that his short game issues are going to come with the more that he plays, the more comfortable that he gets on the golf course. He's always had a phenomenal short game. I don't think he's lost that. At this point, I don't think that he's a victim of the yip. So I just think that everybody needs to be patient. Who knows what the barometer of his success is going to be and what the standard's going to be that everybody thinks that he should meet. It was interesting getting ready for this thing today. I just went online and looked at a internet gambling site to see what some of the odds were on him. And you know, right now, to win a major in 2018, he's listed at 4-1, which is, it's incredible when you consider he's the 600 and 56th ranked player in the world.
Right.
And he hasn't really played for 5 years.
And that may be in some cases. I mean, it's funny you bring that up because I always bring up the betting lines and what the spreads are and stuff. And Mark looks at me and sort of rolls his eyes when he's here, but he's not here, so he can't do it today. I look at those and I know that the early betting lines are usually set by casual fans. And those are people betting with their hearts as they walk by the sports books or whatever. And that he's at 4-1, I think, speaks more to his popularity than the belief that there's a possibility that this guy could actually win and beat these young guys. We've all been waiting to fill that void. Well, I mean, for you, as someone who knows this game as well as anybody and has been around since Tiger first came in and you've seen him through the whole thing, what do you hold as like reasonable expectations of him winning? Not necessarily a major, just winning and being in contention in the events that he is choosing to play in preparation for majors. He's not going to play a big schedule. What do you think? I mean, what's a reasonable expectation?
Well, I think at this point in time, when you get him in a full field, I think a top 10 finish in any full field right now is a tremendous accomplishment. And then I think he takes that and just, gradually, builds on it. I think he's a different player. This is like Tiger Woods 2.0, and you can't compare him with Tiger Woods 1.0 because those days are gone. So you've got this man in this body with all these past experiences, with a whole brand new golf game, and with a different competition set, a group of players out there that are no longer afraid of him. Many players, obviously, who respect him tremendously. But, the intimidation factor is gone, and he's just, right now, he's kind of another guy out there. And I think that it's certainly an interesting storyline for the sport. It's great for the sport. But I guess to answer your question, I mean, I think you start out by finishing in the top 10, and you just keep working your way up. And if he wins anything, okay, any event, I don't care what tour event it is, if he wins any event this year, I think it's a tremendous accomplishment, and he's obviously the comeback player of the year.
Oh, no doubt. And it's funny. Tiger has a transcendent figure. We almost have to view him and his legacy, on two sides of the fence. You've got the people who see him as a cultural icon but aren't really golf junkies, and then you've got the golf junkies. So if you look at what will be Tiger's legacy in those two groups, is his legacy altered if he doesn't win during this comeback, whether it's a one-year comeback, a two-year comeback, five-year comeback, or doesn't win another major? Does that change who Tiger is and what he did for the game and what he did for the game outside of the sport?
No, and again, I get back to this analogy of Tiger Woods 1.0 and Tiger Woods 2.0. I mean, I think that what he did in his prior life is what it is, and that will be what his legacy is. And this is another chapter in his life, and it's a whole different set of circumstances. And I think the expectations should be totally different. And I think, as a sport, we're lucky that we've got arguably at least the second greatest player in the history of the game that's going to be playing at his age, and it's going to be giving us a few thrills out there on the golf course.
Yeah, I mean, we'll never forget Tiger 2.0, while we find it pretty easy to forget Michael Jordan 2.0 with the Wizards or Joe Montana 2.0 with the Chiefs or some of these other guys that we hoped could capture a second career and really were unable to do so. If anybody can do it, it's got to be Tiger. So, we're talking to our good friend Ted Bishop, the former president of the PGA of America, and moving away from Tiger, there are a lot of rules that are going on, a lot of rules that are being discussed, and there are two that I'd like to touch on with you. There's a lot of conversation about the ball and whether the ball, is juiced, and it just is too much activity in the ball. It goes too far. It spins too much. It does all these things. But there's not enough talk, I don't think, about, club technology, which, again, everybody's rolling out new clubs now. It seems like every 6 or 8 months still, despite the fact that I'm not sure who's buying them because I don't know who can afford to swap out their clubs every 6 or 8 months. Should we be talking about clubs at the same time we talk about the ball?
Mike, I think that obviously the distance phenomenon is a combination of all those things. It's a combination of all the clubs and all that. And I think really the bigger issue is that we are at a point in the sport between the professional and the recreational game where we really need bifurcation of the rules. And I just see absolutely absolutely no reason with the technology that exists today by all the major ball manufacturers why we cannot have a different ball that the tour players are using week in and week out. That would be obviously not the same ball that people are going to be playing at the Legends Golf Club are going to be using on Saturday and Sunday. And I think it's the way to, you know, control the distance. You know, getting back to Woods, I remember having sitting with him at a PGA Champions dinner one year at the PGA Championship, and we were talking about distance. And, you know, the topic was based around the ball and drivers. And you know, he said, I think the biggest thing that people lose sight of is how far guys are hitting their irons today. And he said, you know, these guys out here are hitting nine irons 195 yards. And, you know, when you look at that part of the distance equation, you know, maybe the irons are, you know, they're stronger loft-wise than what they had been in the past. You know, who knows how everybody's got them set up. But I think it ultimately gets back to the ball. And I just think that we are rapidly approaching a point where there needs to be a different ball on the PGA Tour than what you and I are seeing week in and week out everywhere across the country.
Yeah, I mean, the bifurcation of rules for the tour players versus the recreational and college and amateur players, I mean, it makes so much sense, it is almost surely not going to happen. Because it just doesn't – it seems like everything is slow to happen in golf. And every other sport, there are different rules for juniors and amateurs and college, and you play it the game a little differently. You know, you've been in those rooms having those high-level conversations. What's the defense of it being the same across the board? Because it really isn't. Tour players, you know, will play these courses from the furthest back tees in the most difficult conditions. So it's not about like an equally setting the handicaps for the holes in the golf courses and the slopes because of the pros. What's the argument for keeping it equal?
Well, I think it gets back to the perception of what I would call the purity of the sport and having every single player who is playing by the rules, playing by the same set of rules. Now, you and I both know the vast majority of recreational players are not playing by the rules. And I will say, I would have kind of subscribed to the theory that you have that, you know, maybe this is a fruitless argument to even be talking about until I saw some of these proposed rules changes come out that are going to be in play in 2019. And, you know, there were some monumental shifts there in the mentality of the USGA and the RNA. And I do think I will give Mike Davis a lot of credit. I think Mike is a smart guy. Mike is a guy that really cares about the game. And while Mike and I have obviously had our differences over the years, I also think that he's learned maybe by some of the mistakes that the USGA made 5-6 years ago. And I think that it is a friendlier organization. And I think that change is more likely to come faster now than it ever has. And I just, when you look at these yardages that these guys are playing and you look at the number of golf courses that are eliminated, you know, from the tournament scope because they can't play at 8,000 yards, something is going to have to be done. And the ball is the only thing they can do, you know, at the elite level to bring many of these courses back. I mean, I was at the U.S. Open at Marion, worked rules there, and I take my hat off to the USGA. I mean, they grew rough. They narrowed fairways. They took a golf course that many people thought was obsolete, and they gave us a great U.S. Open that Justin Rose won. And I think you're going to see some things like this happen, you know, going forward. And I'm hoping that bifurcation is no longer looked at as a bad word. It's looked at as something that'll help the game as a whole.
Yeah, I mean, I love this. I don't mean to fawn all over you, but I could have you on the show every segment, every Saturday, and I would never feel like I heard the same thing twice. So I really appreciate how much you contribute to the show.
I appreciate that.
Before the break, I mean, we talked Tiger. We talked about rolling back some of the technology on the ball. Could we do more, you know, to with the courses themselves to make them more difficult, maybe slightly less perfect? And it was funny to hear Jordan Spieth this week talk about how he likes hitting off of weird lies and stuff like that. He doesn't feel like he's a great you know, player off of a, you know, basically a tarmac. He wants to have some challenges because he does like to shape the ball, and we do see players shape the ball. Can't we control some of that with how we set the courses?
Well, I think we can. You know, a lot of people might not know this, Mike, but my background in golf was actually in agronomy and turf management. I graduated from Purdue with a degree in agronomy and wanted to be a golf course superintendent when I got out of college. And part of what I do day in, day out of my facility, I'm very hands-on with my golf course maintenance crew, and I've really been kind of the superintendent the last couple of years since the PGA stuff ended for me. And, you know, I think some of those things, as I'm sure the superintendents who might be listening to the show today, are easier said than done. I mean, you know, I think everybody that's got a membership or public players is doing whatever they can do right now to try to get people around the golf course in the fastest amount of time they can, try to make the experience as enjoyable as they can. And of course, that starts with, you know, rough heights and green speeds and pin placements and all those things. You know, the fairways, I mean, those of us that are trying to maintain green grass, you know, there's windows of dryness that we have to deal with. And I think that the vast majority of golf courses around the country are doing this stuff right now. And it's all for financial reasons. I mean, we've all seen our operating budgets decrease, and we've had to do things that are, you know, creative. And I don't know how much more impact we can actually have on the recreational game than we do right now. When you get to the tour level and you've got these windows where these guys have got things that they can manipulate and work with, then maybe it's a little bit different. But I just don't know if there's anything revolutionary out there that's going to happen going forward that hadn't already been tried. And that's where I think that it all just gets back to trying to control how far these guys hit it. They're bigger, stronger, faster. The technology, as we said, is better. So there's just going to have to be some major changes in the game going forward.
Yeah, I mean, if you don't mind tapping into that agronomy side of things a little deeper, I mean, it's one thing to say, like, a course like Quail Hollow here in Charlotte, it plays recreationally year-round, and to say, okay, well, you need to widen the rough, narrow the fairways, grow it up, and do all this stuff, and slow the fairways, but speed the greens, that's easier said than done for a window of, like you say, maybe a week or 10 days that these guys are going to be out there playing it, and then expect to return to friendlier conditions that help the day-to-day golfer, correct?
Well, it is. I remember playing at Firestone 1 year. I was actually played the day before. This was when the old World Series of Golf was going on before the WGC events, and I remember there being a sign on the first tee that said, no penalty today for lost balls and rough. And obviously, they were growing the rough and getting it ready for the PGA Tour event, and it was unplayable conditions for the average person. And so there's just no way that you can even begin to mix these things up. And again, get back to the USGA, and you look at what they did at Pinehurst the last time they played a U.S. Open there, and how they transformed that course, and how they tried to make the concept of brown being beautiful something maybe that would stick and would happen at some other places around the country. My players who come out here and want to pay $50 to play a round of golf on the weekend are not looking forward to playing in brown conditions.
Right.
You know, they want turf conditions that are acceptable. So it's a hard road for most normal operators to go down.
Yeah, so going back to the one of our original points, the first point of emphasis might have to be changing the ball for the pros, bifurcating those rules, as you said, to make sure that these guys, you know, we can play on the same course, but it'll still be a different game for them, make it a little bit harder. Because we do love those guys who can shape their shots. All right, well, we're talking to Ted Bishop, our good friend, the former president of the PGA of America, and transitioning. I always love to talk to you about the Ryder Cup. And right now, Mark and I debated this last show before our hiatus, I guess. If Phil and Tiger don't automatically qualify for the Ryder Cup, I mean, are those guys, where would they have to be to legitimately be a pick? And are there different criteria for each of them based on what they bring as leaders and historic, you know, players in team competition?
Well, I think that's a really interesting topic, and I would go back to you know, the Ryder Cup Task Force, which I actually appointed after Glenn Eagles, and those were the first two calls that I made on that task force. were to Phil and to Tiger to make sure they were all in, and they were very influential in some of the things that came out. And I would think that both those guys, either one of them, would have to be well within the top 20 Ryder Cup points for Jim Furyk to even give them a look. And I would also hope that both Tiger and Phil would understand, I think, the responsibility that they have as what I would call transitional players, to understand, as bad as they may want to play in what could very well be their final Ryder Cup, they have an obligation to the system and to the younger players to refuse a spot on the Ryder Cup team if they're not within the top 20 in the standings. And you know, Furyk is a – I mean, Jim's a guy that won't be afraid to make tough decisions, and he's also very good friends with both Tiger and Phil. And I think that's the way it'll play out. I don't think you'll see any ceremonial picks given either one of those two guys. And then their role going forward, you've already seen Woods do this at the last Ryder Cup, will be to fall into the role of assistant captains, which is what they're going to need to do in order to adhere to the system that will someday allow both of them to be Ryder Cup captains. And, you know, I did a story for Morning Read last summer. And, you know, I said that I thought that Woods probably now is in line to be the 2022 Ryder Cup captain. That's a lot sooner than I would have once thought it would have been.
Mm-hmm.
But that was back when I thought he would, you know, still be, you know, playing at a higher level for a long time. And I think Mickelson will be the captain in 24 at Bethpage. And Stricker is going to be the captain in 20. And so I think you're going to see a lot of Tiger and Phil at these Ryder Cups, but I really don't think it's going to be as players. I think it's going to be as assistant captains, because that's what their transitional role needs to be in the next few years.
Well, give us a peek behind the curtain on these guys. What, you know, whether as a captain or as a playing member of the team, what does each bring to that room? Behind closed doors, what does each bring, and is it different?
Yeah, you know, I'm going to be real honest with you, and I was fortunate to be in team rooms at Celtic Manor in 2010 and Medina in 2012. You know, Watson ran a different team room in 14, so can't say that was the case at Glen Eagles. But I think the experience in the team room is the most overrated thing that is discussed in golf. You know, this is a week where these guys enjoy being together. It's a week where they get to play team golf, which is something they haven't done since college. And I've been there. I've done that stuff. I've heard the things that are said in the team room. I've observed these guys during the week of the Ryder Cup, and I think it's way overrated. And you know, you got a situation right now where the cycle has changed, and the Americans clearly have the better talent than the Europeans do. And I think for a long time, it was the opposite. The Europeans had better players than we did. But that's all changed now. And I got to be honest with you, you and I could captain these next four or five Ryder Cups, and we're going to win because of the people that that are on our team. And you can talk all you want about the captains and all the influence you might think that they're going to have on the outcome of the Ryder Cup. But the fact of the matter is, it always boils down to the players and how they play. And right now, we've got superior talent, and you saw Stricker say that after the President's Cup. I mean, I saw a quote, Steve Edberg said, I just needed to stay out of the way and let these guys play. And that's kind of where we're at. So that's my take on it. It always has been about the quality of the players more so than the captains. And you know, this stuff about these kumbaya moments in the team room and how that motivates players the following day on the next tee is crap, in my opinion.
Yeah, well, I agree. Linking pinkies and singing kumbaya isn't going to help you win match play. So I'm curious if it ends up that we go, as you're predicting, Furyk, Stricker, Woods, Mickelson, who's left out? Who, you know, when you talk about who's been leapfrogged, I mean, is there somebody out there that is going to miss out on being a Ryder Cup captain who, A, deserves it, B, has set himself up for it, and I guess, C, that we wish we would have had an opportunity?
Yeah, I'll give you three names. And if you go back to when I was president, and you know, when I named Tom Watson, at Glen Eagles. We did so because Tom had won 5 major championships in Scotland. He'd won 5 British Opens over there, and obviously that's where the Ryder Cup was going to be played. And we hadn't won, still haven't won a foreign Ryder Cup since 93 when Watson captained the U.S. at the Belfry. So to me, it made Tom the obvious pick. The guy that was next up on that list that the PGA of America had hidden somewhere down there at Palm Beach Gardens was David Toms. And so David got left out probably in 2014 when I was president. I would say the other two guys, they're probably unfortunately going to get bypassed at this point, might be Stuart Sink and Justin Leonard. And those would be guys that, you know, would have previously been on that list before this task force would have been formed. And that's just my take. I could be wrong, but boy, one thing, you certainly don't hear those three names bannered around much anymore. And I think prior to Glen Eagles and the way we changed things there, all three of them would have been in line to be Ryder Cup captains. Mm.
Well, before we let you go, Ted, I'm curious what you think about the changes that we made to the rules with regard to video replay and fans sitting at home with their 4K HD TVs and slow motion replay calling in and affecting play. I mean, I think that everybody has made the right move here in eliminating that, but I'm curious about how you feel about once the scorecard is signed and it's attested by the person who was walking with you, your playing partner, yourself, your caddy, and everything else, that going back and revising scores after they've been turned in is still a possibility. Is that the next step? Is that something that needs to change?
Yeah, that just can't happen. I mean, when scores are signed at the highest level like that, it's over with. I mean, I just think that's it. I don't think anybody out there's, you know, really ever tried to cheat or do anything that would be against the spirit of the rules. And, you know, we're going to see it this weekend. I mean, I think that instant replay is getting to the point where it's absolutely starting to ruin professional college football. And, you know, there's always going to be a need, I think, at the highest level of these competitions to make sure that, you know, fairness in whatever the sport is was played out, the right call was made. But at the same time, there's just the human element that's all part of this. And in golf, when the round's over with, the scorecards have been signed, the scores have been posted, to change anything after that just seems to me to be absolutely ludicrous and is really taken away from our sport.
Amen, my friend. Well, that's a good one to end on. Ted, thank you so much for joining us, as always, and Happy New Year.
Hey, Mike, thanks, and look forward to talking with you again.
Yeah, we'll talk soon. Take care.